Spencer, do you mind leaving us in a prayer? Thank you.
Right. Our dear God and Father in heaven, thank you for another day that you've blessed us with, and we're thankful for the opportunity we have tonight to come together and to read your word, see what you have to say to us. Help us to approach the word with open and honest hearts and be able to glean from your word and apply it to our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. So we're in Samuel. We're going to wrap up from 2:12 on to the end of 4. There's a whole lot of little stories that happen in here. It gets downright Shakespearean in the amount of murders and spear thrusting that happens. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. Again, this is just one of those chunks that it's sort of filling in the gap between David becoming sort of king and becoming really king. We're going to talk about that as we go. So, is David a king right now?
Yes.
Yes. Of what?
Judah.
Judah. Just Judah. Okay? And the rest of them are sort of are following who?
Ish-bosheth.
Ish-bosheth, who is the puppet of?
Joab.
You're ready for the spear thrusting.
We're coming up to one of my favorite accounts in the Old Testament.
Yeah. Hopefully I will do it justice. So, we're talking about David's rise to power, and then Travis is going to take over the actual, like, he's going to become partial king to full king in the next two classes. I will then take over with, I don't remember what my topic is. I got like one more class. I only teach one more time because I apparently can't read the calendar, and when the elders asked me to teach, I was like, sure, I can do third quarter. And then I realized that June, when I'm leading a trip to Washington, D.C. next week with 45 kids, and then we're in Tampa for 3 weeks. We figured that out after we figured out that we also weren't here for the first week because we were on fall break together. So, note to self, don't self teach third quarter anymore.
It's second quarter.
Second quarter. Maybe third.
You're not good at math either.
No, that's why I teach history. Okay, so
I agree with that one.
So, chapter 2. Joab enters. We're going to talk about Joab, and it's sort of interesting that... Oh, the battery's already died. Yep. So it's interesting here that Joab sort of shows up, right? Let's not worry about it. We got this last up there. Joab's just sort of there. Who is Joab?
Nephew.
He's his nephew, okay?
David's nephew.
Yes. He's eventually going to be the general. Who is his contemporary, like his equal right now on the other side of this? Abner. Remember that. It's going to come into play here in a second. And one of the little asides that they're going to add has some interesting historical context in there about why these guys are going to hate each other so much. So the first thing that's going to happen is we're going to be in chapter 2, verse 12, and let's start looking there. It says... Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, son of Saul. He made him king. We're going to go all the way down to verse 10, or verse 12, I'm sorry. Abner, son of Ner, together with the men of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, left Mahanaim and went to Gibeon. Joab, son of Zeruiah, and David's men went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. So the pool of Gibeon, I cannot pass up a chance to talk about geography. So here we go. Jerusalem? Try to plug this in. So Jerusalem is on there, right? And northwest of Jerusalem is what? Gibeon. How far do we think that is?
3-4 miles.
3-4 miles? Not far at all. Yeah, maybe 5. But what it is you can see that right here, there's Jerusalem's up on a mountain, Gibeon's up on a mountain. It's a high place. Who worshipped at Gibeon? At the high place of Gibeon? We have notes that who? Saul, David, Solomon, all of who's who have worshipped at this high place. Okay? It's a pretty big deal. So we're over in Gibeon, Jerusalem, so David's people are here, about Naush, right? Down in Hebron. And Menahemah is over in this side, okay? Like I said, forever, and we'll call it that. Just hope that's not the question of when you get to heaven, they're like, okay, one last question to get you in. Where did Ishbosheth become a king? And you say Menominah, and I'll feel bad because you're going to hell. The world will say, yeah, close enough. So, this is the pool at Gibeon. They're about 98% certain. There actually was a blog that talked about that. It said we are 98% certain that this is the pool that is discussed. It is about 78 feet dug down. Interestingly enough, you would expect a pool to be in a high elevation or a low elevation of a town. The low elevation, right? Except this is at the high elevation. Because what happens is Gibeon is up on a hill, right? And there's a water table that flows here, and there's a sloping spring that feeds into this water table. And so what happened is they dug this pit all the way down to the water table, and it slopes back. Okay, and the water fills in. I'll show you a couple more pictures. But that is solid rock that they've dug straight through. You can't see it in this picture. I looked for a better one that didn't have a huge watermark on it, but this staircase winds all the way down, and then there was a floor where they could lower buckets and stuff down into the water. The floor was there, and they know in the Crusades because they have depictions of it, but they don't know if it was there back way back. So here we go. Here's that what I was talking about. So it's a water shaft. They've dug down the steps going to the spring here. You got a sloping tunnel, water chamber, and this is the bottom of the hill where the water sort of, it doesn't just stop there magically, okay? It does, it sort of flows out right there. But there's the city wall, and it's just interesting that they thought, you know what, there was water here, maybe if we dig down far enough, we'll go. So 10 meters there, so freedom units, that's about how many feet? What's that? Yeah, ish. And so, yeah.
And solid rock?
Yeah.
Man, that's a lot of work.
It is. So, but that's what they did it, and that's how they get their water. So they all go chill at this place. I did want to show you this right here. So this is the high place of Gibeon. This is where they would have worshipped. That well is right in this area. But as you look over, you can see Mount of Olives is right here. The Dome of the Rock is there, and Jerusalem is this area. So just like any major city, major metropolitan area, it has sprawled, right? You ever fly over New York and you see the beginning of New York? I can't remember what they called it. Boswash? I don't remember. But it's New York to Boston. From Boston to Washington, D.C., it's pretty much just solid city. You never really know when you go from one to the next. That's what it is now. So when you see this, this would have been open ground, probably had some kind of farmland in the middle. And this would be looking south and west, or south and east. Yeah, south and east. Okay. But those pictures, this gives us, I think these give us a lot of context of how far this is. So 5 miles.
Foot's a, that's a lot.
Yeah. That's, yeah. I mean, it's
2 hours walk.
Yeah, 2 hours walk.
Okay, but if we're taking little kids.
Plus a lot up and down.
Yeah, plus.
That terrain would have added at least an hour.
Yeah, so, and you would be going downhill on the first half and uphill on the second half. Well, probably downhill on a third, flat for a third, uphill for a third.
If you have kids, and you know, and if you were taking animals to Jerusalem.
Yeah. Well, this also just gives you a little more information about when they say the lookouts looked and they saw. Yeah, you could totally. I can picture standing here and being able to see an army or a camp or whatever the 4 or 5 miles away that it could have been that far away.
And then, plus the pollution level wasn't like it is today.
It's not as, it wouldn't have been as hazy.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, another picture. Nope, I got 4. So, question about that. That's my geography lesson of the day. Gives a little more there. So they show up, and what are they saying? Then Abner said to Joab. So they both show up with men. We don't know how many men. It said the men of David. At any time, sometimes David is said to have 400 men with him. That's when, how many settled in Hebron, right? And David is said to have 300 men with him sometimes. And we don't know how many men go there. So then Abner said to Joab, let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand to hand in front of us. All right, let them do it, Joab said. So they stood up and were counted off 12 men for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth and Saul and 12 for David. Okay? So
representative combat, trial by combat. We're going to do it this way. Instead of having the whole army fight, let's have just 12 guys fight each other, and then we'll call it out. We've seen this before with David and Goliath. You see this all a lot of times. You'll see it in the Dark Ages. There's a guy named Vercingetorix who said, you know what? I'll fight anybody in your army. If I win, you all are our slaves. If he wins, all my guys will kill themselves. And so Vercingetorix walks out on this bridge. They send out their champion, and he pulls out this 6-foot-long sword, cuts the guy's head off, and then tells his army to go kill him anyways. So, glad you don't live in the Dark Ages. But they would do this to save what?
Lives.
Save lives, right? It is difficult to replace manpower. And that's one of the things that you look at. When you look at the punishments for some of the things that happened back in ancient times, Hammurabi's Code, the Jewish law, it isn't imprisonment, right? It is quick, it is decisive, because you don't have the time and the manpower to feed people who aren't feeding themselves. And so, deal with it and move on. So they use representative combat to stop the loss of manpower. Smaller forces would help for it, so they didn't get just completely wiped out by big forces. There's an old Roman quote that said, the gods are with the big legions. Have you ever heard that before? Which means, you know, the big legions are always the one that wins. That's the one the gods with, right? So, questions there? Pretty simple. Verse 16, then each man grabbed his opponent by the head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's sides, and they fell down together. So that place in Gibeon was called Helkath Hazurim. Right? So what is that? Does anybody's house have something besides Helkath Hazurim?
Field of blades.
Field of blades, field of sharp swords.
Mm-hmm. Field of sharp swords.
This is one of those, like, there are dozens of names. The field of sorrows, the field of heroes, the field of blood. There's one that translates the field of blood. But the place of heroes is another one that comes up. Which people are the heroes? Because it just says they all fell down dead together. So I picture them all just, and then all falling over. I'm sure there's more to it. This is just a poetic way of saying they fought and they died. So who won? It doesn't say who won. So we're going to get to that here in a second.
If all 24 men died?
Yeah.
The battle's a draw.
It's a draw, yeah. So I would say it was probably David's men were victorious there because of what's going to happen next. The battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the Israelites were defeated by David's men. And we're going to get some numbers in a second, because some people will read that and say, oh, that's those 12 guys fighting it out, 12 and 12 fighting it out, but it's not. And we're going to see that here in a second. So fighting happens, fierce battle, Abner and the Israelites are defeated by David's men. So what happens next? What happens in almost every battle we've read about so far? There's the fighting, then there's the fleeing or the chasing, right? The fighting and the chasing. So we're at the chasing portion where you run them down and you kill as many as you can before they can re-rally, correct? And so who's chasing who at this point?
Abner is chasing Abner.
Yeah, so let's look at, we're going to look at this. So there's going to be a little bit of an aside here where it says the three sons of Zerah were there. Joab, Abishai, and Ashiel. Now, Ashiel was fleet-footed as a wild gazelle. That is not a description I've ever had given of myself. But, so he was quick, right? And so he is probably in the front of this chasing. Whenever you read about these, it is not organized. It is you go as fast as you can, you catch as many as you can, and you kill them very quickly. And you move on, and you try to keep going to make it even more decisive, right? Because if you give them a chance to gather up, which we're going to see in a second, that's when you have to stop. And so Abner is going to appeal to Ashiel a couple times, okay? And we're going to have to think about this as we go forward. So then Abner said to him, turn aside to the right and the left. Take one of the young men and strip him of his weapons. But Ashiel would not stop chasing him, right? Because remember, you kill it, you keep it, right? So if you kill the guy, you get his weapons. And would Abner have nice weapons?
Yes,
because he is effectively the de facto king, he is the power behind the throne. He's wealthy.
He's good. So he's going to have good stuff to steal. And then 22, and then again, Abner warned Asahel, stop chasing me. Why should I strike you down? How could I look at you, look your brother Joab in the face? Okay? Two times, right? He tells him, stop, or I'm going to kill you. One time he specifically says, I'm going to kill you. The other time says, go after somebody else, right? You don't want this, effectively, I think what he's saying.
You don't want a piece of meat.
Yeah. He said, you don't, yeah. I was one of the kids said, you don't want a piece. I was like, no, the whole thing, let's go. Or there was a kid that got in a fight once when I see this section, really funny. And he said, the kid said, you don't want none of me. And he was a big boy. He's like, there's enough to go around. And I was like, oh. Like, fat joke and a fight joke all the same time. Good job, man. So, was Asahel, how do we ask this? Should he have stopped?
No, I don't think so.
Hindsight.
Okay. Hindsight, yeah, hindsight. You look back and you're like, oh, I just got a spear thrust on me. I probably should have stopped. And I bet those younger men were looking a little nice when he looks down and sees a spear poking out his back. But Asahel refused to give up the pursuit, so Abner thrust the butt of his spear into Asahel's stomach, and the spear came out through his back. He fell there and died on the spot, and every man stopped when he came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died. This is brutal, because it's not just the spear part of it, it's the butt of his spear. So the blunt end of his spear, he rams through. That's pretty brutal. The other thing is, Abner, even though he is older, probably is an accomplished fighter. Okay, and I wouldn't say probably, he is. He has to be be in the position he is. And he would have, actually I would have known what he's doing. What he was getting ready to take part of. So, is Abner guilty of murdering Asahel?
Self-defense and battle.
It's self-defense, yeah. And any warrior in this culture would have noticed that and would have known that. So, remember that as we go forward a little bit. Any points here so far? Yeah.
Hey, have you ever thought about how exactly that took place? How Abner probably just came to a sudden stop with his spear braced to his side? Because they were running.
Yep.
And then Asahel or Asahel would have just ran right into the butt end of his spear, and that's...
Yeah. Well, he would have had to swing it, too. He may have been flying fast as a gazelle, but you don't, like... You can't really run yourself onto a spear. He would have definitely...
Haven't you ever played that game when you were kids? When you're chasing each other and the person in front
stabs them with a spear,
across to their knees, and the other person
jumps
over
them
and comes flying.
Yeah.
The like butt that. End of a spear, that's the thing that catches me.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like he just did that. You know, if it's a sharp end of it, it's obviously.
Yeah.
But is he said, well, you know, I killed him with the end, of the bad end of the spear.
Yeah, and a lot of the commenters are that it was. We'll say that it was he was not trying to kill him. It was more that he was trying to use a non-lethal stroke, and it just happens to kill him. There are a lot of people who read stuff into this, and Josephus is one of them. Josephus is going to tell a story of his history that is a little very critical of Asahel and very forgiving of Abner. And so we'll see that here.
Have you seen the movies where they'll take up something and they'll take the money to try to push something back?
Yeah.
So, could
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
How much of a head start did he get Abner had on him?
No telling. I mean, he's a gazelle. Abner's probably 20-ish years older than him.
So, I'm thinking the last thing you want to do when someone's chasing you is to try and talk to them.
Yeah. Well, and...
turn around and say, hey, hold on.
Well, over terrain, he would probably have a chance to stop at some point and be like, hey, chill, I don't want this, you don't want this, and then... scurry off a little farther. We also don't know a distance. A lot of times it'll give you a distance. It doesn't give us a distance of how far they had gone. So then both are going to withdraw. So we're going to hop down into verse 26 real quick. So all the guys stopped where Asahel had died, and they all presumed as the sun was setting. The men of Benjamin had rallied around Abner at this point, and then it's going to come up to... at the top of a hill, so they have high ground. You don't go up for the high ground because you're going to be tired once you get up there.
and you're gonna be trying to kill people, so it's not a good idea. So Abner called out to Joab, must the sword devour forever? Don't you realize that this will end in bitterness? How long before you order your men to stop pursuing their fellow Israelites? And then in verse 27 it says, Joab answered, as surely as God lives, if you had not spoken, the men would have continued pursuing them until morning. So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the troops came to a halt. They no longer pursued Israel, nor did they fight anymore. So, had Joab chilled by this point?
No. Very deep.
I think he has at this point. I think he has seen that it is a losing battle. I think there's a little bit of animosity that's going to be there, but I don't think it's going to be because he killed his brother. I think he's going to realize that his brother getting killed was part of the battle. I really think that Joab's hatred of Abner is political, because if Abner comes back to David, what's going to happen to Joab?
Second.
He's going to go from second in command to second in command to second in command. Most likely. And so we'll talk about that in a second. So they stop, they go home, and then when they count the dead, or actually, it doesn't even say dead here. What does it say? Missing. When they counted the missing, how many people were missing on David's side? 19 plus 1, because it said 19 in addition to who? Asahel, who got speared. And then the Israelites' dead was 360. So, decisive victory for David's men. We don't know how many were there to begin with. We don't know percentages. And my question is, does this count the 12 from each side from before?
Well, I don't know.
That was just a question I had. Anything there with you guys before we close out chapter 2 and get into 3 real quick? Okay. Chapter 3, Abner goes over to David. There's really not a lot here besides just the story of him doing this and some other stuff. So Ishbosheth runs his mouth about Abner, and Abner is less than thrilled is really the subtitle I've got for this one. So I'm just going to read through real quick in order to talk about it. So during the, verses 1 through 5, what's it list out?
The sons of David.
The sons of David, right? Anybody want to discuss the sons of David real quick?
He had lots
of sons, yeah. We're just going to, lots of sons. Amnon, all those good ones. So here we go. So during the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner has been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine named Rizpah, daughter of I can't say that correctly, and Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why did you sleep with my father's concubine?" Abner was very angry because of what Ishbosheth said. So he answered, "Am I a dog's head on Judah's side? This very day I am loyal to the house of your father Saul and his family and friends. I haven't handed you over to David." And you can sort of read that little subcontext. What is it? "I haven't handed you over, even though I could." Right? And like there's a little subtext there. And yet now you accuse me of an offense involving this woman. May God deal with Abner, be it ever so severely, if I do not do for David what the Lord promised him on oath, and transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and establish David's throne over Israel and Judah from Dan to Beersheba. Ishbosheth did not dare say another word to Abner because he was afraid of him. Because what did Abner just tell him?
"I can hand you over and take your kingdom."
He said, "I'm going to."
Yeah.
He said, "May God deal with me ever so severely if I don't do this." So, there you go. And Ishbosheth is not seen that. I just sort of see him sort of like, you always see those puppet kings in TV shows and books and stuff, and they're just always sort of sitting there like playing king while everybody else, the big guys, are making the decisions. That's sort of how I see Ishbosheth here. I don't think he was, A, ready for this because Jonathan was supposed to do this, and Abner is just using him as a tool at this point. Anybody else see it differently?
It's a big deal, Abner sleeping with Saul's concubine, though. This is in an honor shame culture like they're
yeah.
in. Like this is sort of it's a power play.
Yeah.
And I mean, Absalom's going to do the same thing.
So the question is, did it happen?
He never denied it.
He does say.
"No, you
accuse me of this.
You accuse me of this of an offense involving this woman. Correct. And so there are commenters on both sides who think, the majority think, yes, he did probably do it, because it is a power play. It is a political maneuver.
Calling Bill Clinton,
it's territorial.
No.
No.
Opposite. I mean the opposite. Will says, I did not sleep with this woman.
No, yeah. This is territorial from his, it really is a, this is my property now. I'm the power here.
Yeah.
And so what's his is mine kind of stuff. What's that?
It felt like he deserved it.
Yeah.
These are my rewards. I what I've done for you.
With the side reading that I've done, I believe he did do it. Mm-hmm. And he's angry, A, that he got called out, and B, that this guy he made is calling him out, right? I just sort of see Ishbosheth sort of like, yeah, I'm going to get him. I'm big and bad. And he says it, and it's just like, because I'll tell you, there was one time, the corollary to this in my life is there was a time when my brother's 6 years older than me, and I was about 14, and I thought I was big and bad, and I thought I was going to punch him in the face. And, like, I did it, and then I looked over at him, and I thought, I was like, and he just looked over, and he said, everybody gets one mistake. And he just, he was also driving the car when he did it. I did that, so that probably wasn't smart either.
Sorry.
He was. You want my speech on how, like, teenagers and being brain damaged? Because I will admit that I was stupid then.
So did you have, like, an Amber Joab moment? Like, hey, truce. Now's a good time for a truce.
Yeah, no. We pulled up to where we were going. He had my sister get out, and he said, you ever do that again, and I'll push you out of the car. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. I just sort of sat there like this the whole time. Don't tell Mom. Don't tell Dad. But he did. So, we're going to move on to verse 12. So Abner and Jonathan, he didn't make a deal with nobody, he did. Abner and David are going to make a deal, okay? And so in 17, Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, which I think is interesting. He doesn't go straight to David. He goes to the elders of Israel first, and he says, for some time you wanted to make David your king, now do it, for the Lord promised David, by my servant David, I will rescue my people of Israel. My people Israel, from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. So, this just shows how smart Abner is. If he goes to David and he's just like, hey, let's do this. But if he talks about it first, this is the equivalent, I feel like, of asking if your friend can stay the night in front of your friend and your parents. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, he's already got it going. He's already got the plan in place, and he doesn't want to get embarrassed. He's like, don't embarrass me in front of the elders. I've already talked to him. Right? Like, got it going. And I think this shows Abner is a political genius, I feel like. And I think there are several things that would point to that. Or at least he is for just a little while longer. So, Abner also spoke to the Benjamites in person, which is just as important. So when it says conferred with, a lot of the commenters believe that it is sending out messengers to tell everybody, hey, you should definitely make David your king now. But he spoke specifically to the elders of his own family, his people. And he said, then he went to Hebron to tell David everything that Israel and the whole tribe of Benjamin wanted to do. Okay? So when Abner, who had 20 men with him, came to David in Hebron, David prepared a feast for him and his men. And then Abner said to David, let me go once and assemble all Israel for my lord, the king, so that they may make a covenant with you and that you may rule over that all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away and he went in peace. That's the important part, right? Because he prepares a feast for him, because he has respect for him, right?
23rd Psalm.
But does
feast in the presence of enemies.
Yeah, does he have to let him go, though? That's the sign that everything's cool, right? Because they'll bring you in and be hospitable, but the fact that you get to leave in peace is the big deal, okay? And that is a big deal there. Yeah, so Joab returns. I think I skipped a part of my notes real quick. Let me make sure over here. I did skip 12 to 15 real quick. What happens in 12 to 15? What does David say? Because he sends messengers to David, right? He says, hey, I want to make a deal. And David says, don't come to me unless you have who with me?
Michael.
The one that's going to make fun of him later, right? Bring her there, and I want to go back to this where it says, give me my wife Michael, whom I betrothed myself for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins. He's like, she was expensive.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. You pay those guys a lot to get those things from, usually by stabbing them to death first. But the 16, her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Baharim. Then Amber, I just love that they put this in here. Then Abner said to him, "Go home." So he went back. Like, that is one of those questions of like, what possessed the Holy Spirit to tell us that Abner had to be like, "Go home." Like, that's an interesting addition to me. So
like Peter and the apostle both ran to the tomb, but the other apostle outran Peter?
Yeah. Yeah, you tell us Peter's like, "Abner, not
that." Well, to me it's indicative of that she was in a pleasant relationship to come into one where she's one of many.
Yeah.
And then later you see how she, what disdain she treats him when he brings the ark in.
Yeah.
And so she basically hates him and...
But notice it doesn't say anything about her opinion. It only says his. Like, he's pretty sad about it.
That's okay with the girl.
Yeah. So, in 22 through, we're looking at 24 and 25 real quick. Sorry, I cut a bunch of stuff down here to talk about it. So Joab went to the king. So he comes back, right? And he says, he sent away in peace. When Joab heard about that, he goes back. Okay? And he says, "What have you done?" Into verse 24. "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he is gone. You know Abner, son of Ner, and he came to deceive you and observe your movements and find out everything you are doing." So he is accusing Abner of spying, right? And he says, so as simply as I put it, Joab goes after Abner and murders him. Okay? More specifically, he pulls him back, he talks to him. "Now when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside and into an inner chamber as if to speak with him privately, and there, to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel, Joab stabbed him in the stomach, and he died." And we're going to talk about a little bit more here in a second. So, verse 26 and 27, where is that? I think I put the wrong verse there. So Josephus, very specifically, the historian of this, specifically says in his history that the brother was killed in lawful combat. Joab would have been a man who understood that, and so he would have forgiven him for that. He knows his battle, that this would have been a political murder. Okay? How many of y'all, if you look down at verse 30, it's in parentheses. Joab and his brother Abishai had murdered Abner because he had killed his brother Asahel in the Battle of Gibeon. Is anybody in parentheses?
No.
Yeah. So if you see those in parentheses, that is a verse that is either the translators believe that it was either added later, like mine's in parentheses, or it is a verse that was added for like clarity, if that makes sense. Which I don't think it needs much clarity, more clarity. So does it matter? No. But Joab is going to cause problems a lot. That's the main thing I want you to pull away from this, is that Joab is going to be a pain in the butt for David for a while. Okay? He's also going to collude with David quite a bit with the whole Bathsheba and Uriah incident, if you think about it later. So David's response is very telling, though. Okay? In verse 28 or verse 29, he says... "Later when David heard about this, he said, I and my kingdom are forever innocent before the Lord concerning the blood of Abner, son of Ner. May his blood fall on the head of Joab and his whole family. May Joab's family never be without someone who has a running sore or leprosy, or who leans on a crutch, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks food." So leprosy, by the way, there's not just like leprosy. That's a generic term for weeping sores, open sores, flesh-eating bacteria. A lot of fun stuff we don't have anymore outside of specific areas. And then we get to David's lament in verse 33 and 34. So is David upset about this? Yes. Because what does David realize that Abner is? He's going to call him a very specific title later. So it's going to say in 33 and 34... "So they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb, and all the people wept also. The king sang this lament for Abner. Should Abner have died as the lawless die? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. You fell as one falls before the wicked, and all the people wept over him again. Then they all came and urged David to eat something while it was still day. But David took an oath, saying, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I taste bread or anything before the sun sets." All the people took note and were pleased. Indeed, everything the king did pleased them. So on that day, all the people of Israel knew that the king had no part in the murder of Abner, son of Ner. Look how sad he is. He couldn't have had anything to do with this. Okay? There are some very cynical commentators who will say that that David probably ordered it. I think that's a reach. So,
calls him a prince in verse 38.
Yeah, he does. And so that's where I think the whole argument falls apart for most of those guys. Then the king said to his men, "Do you not realize that a commander and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am an anointed king, I am weak, and these sons of Zeruiah are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds." I don't think he had anything to do with it, frankly. Some argue it. I think it's a weak case. Any questions there? I think, again, we see David's character. We see his character as a man who respects talent, but also who respects, at this point in his life, a forward. Like, would he have been as sad if Joab and Abner met on the battlefield and Joab killed Abner? I don't think so. Under the right circumstances. But it was more that he was murdered like the logs. Yeah.
Well, it's very possible that David served with Abner in Saul's army.
Oh, he would have, for sure. Yeah, he would have had.
I mean, they may have had a personal relationship with one another.
Yeah. And I think that's very telling that he, my translation says a great man or a prince, or this is a loss. He is a commander of men, which is, that leadership skill is not always there. So chapter 4, we get another murder. Told you it was getting Shakespearean. And this is one of the best understatements of the Bible. When Ishbosheth, son of Saul, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage and all Israel became alarmed. Just a little alarmed that Abner was dead, because while Ishbosheth is a puppet, is he probably very much aware of the power Abner has? I think so. I think he understands that Abner is the only thing keeping him alive. Now Abner's gone. He's rudderless at this point. He's lost that commander of men. And Ishbosheth is not that, from what we can see so far.
Well, he, in the last chapter, he even said he fears Abner. Yeah. He knows Abner has that power.
Yeah.
So.
Well, he'd also just gotten told off and told that I'm going to make somebody else king in your place. Well, what's interesting that they don't ever mention in this section until the very end of this, and it's only obliquely. What deal did David and Saul make?
David and Jonathan, you mean?
Well, both.
Not to kill the members of Saul's family.
Mm-hmm. And then Saul, at the very end, David tells him, "I'm not going to kill your family. When I become king, may God deal with me ever so severely if I do this." And he promises he's not going to. And I think that's important that we still haven't mentioned that, right? The murder of Ishbosheth, so I'm going to read through this really quick. And we're going to talk about, in verse 4, real fast. So verse 2 and 3, it just talks about who these guys were. One was named Bana, the other was named Rechab, and the sons of Rimmon and Bethrai from the tribe of Benjamin. And Beeroth is considered part of Benjamin because the people of Beeroth fled to Gideon and have resided there as foreigners to this day. Interesting story. I'd like to know why. I didn't get a chance to dig into it that deeply. But then there's an aside at verse 4. And it says, and this is in parentheses, "Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell and became disabled. His name was Mephibosheth." Okay, so don't know what that means. If you look at the Greek, it's a little more specific, that he either had a spinal injury and couldn't move his feet, or when he fell, he broke his legs and they couldn't set them correctly. Why couldn't he be king? Because he's crippled. He couldn't leave his people, right? He was lame. They would not have even pictured that, right? So here's the murder of Ishbosheth real fast in four verses.
Now Rechab-Bana and Bana, the sons of Rimmon the Beathrite, set out for the house of Ish-bosheth, and they arrived there in the heat of the day while he was taking his noonday rest. It's hot. Ish-bosheth is resting. They went into the inner part of the house as if to get some wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and his brother Bana slipped away. They had gone into the house while he was lying on his bed in his bedroom. After they stabbed him and killed him, they cut off his head, taking with them. They traveled all night by way of Araba. They brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, your enemy, who tried to kill you. This day the Lord has avenged my lord, the king, against Saul and his offspring." So who killed him? Who tried to kill David?
Saul.
But they're like, hey, look, Saul tried to kill you. I got the king this time. So I think that's important. There's the Midrash I told you about the other day, where it's like the rabbinic teachings of it. It talks about how there was a guy who was shelling wheat at the door, and they snuck by him as if to like get wheat. And he already had his wheat, so they wanted to get some more. It's sort of interesting. I don't know why they decided that was a detail that they should tell, but there we go. So I titled this slide, Rechab and Bana do not know their history, because they probably would have understood this was a bad idea if they had just thought about it. So starting at verse 9, as surely as the Lord lived, this is David speaking, by the way. As sure as the Lord lived, who has delivered me out of every trouble, when someone told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and put him to death at Ziklag. That was the reward I gave him for his news. And at this point, this is another one of those. I wish I could be, so David's standing here just looking over his shoulder at these two guys, holding his head, and like, they're just like, agreeing, yeah, okay. And then he hits that line where he says, I seized him and put him to death. That was the reward I gave him. And they go, they're just like, wait a second. At what point do they want to like, just leave? I would have hopefully been sooner than that. So how much more when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed, should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you? And they're like, no, you shouldn't. You probably shouldn't. I think it's important that he calls Ish-bosheth what? Yeah, he calls him an innocent man, which is very telling, right? He's done nothing wrong to me. He has caused no problems for me. All he is just there, right? I think there would have been a little more of a description outside of that. So, questions? Yeah?
I was going to say, I also think it's interesting. This also kind of shows David's character. He's mad that they killed him in his own bed. It's not, it's killing an unarmed man. The same with, like, Abner. You didn't kill him in battle. You just murdered him.
Yeah.
And there's a difference.
So I think...
And David gets upset about that.
I think these three chapters show us David is very much a man of honor. And he believes that that's a big deal for him, at least right now he is. I mean, we're going to probably change it a little bit.
You know, defeat a warrior in war is honorable.
Yeah.
But to murder them in cowardice, kind of like assassination, is not with honor. I know that sounds kind of Klingon-ish, but,
So verse 12, the last part. So David gave an order to his men, and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung the bodies by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb at Hebron. I find it interesting there's no lament here, though. Like, because when Saul and Jonathan died, he had the big, long lament. And then when Abner died, he got a little bit more of a less of a lament. But there's no lament here. I think that's interesting. I don't think David would have had as strong a connection to Ish-bosheth because they probably would have been separated for at least the last 10 years, if not longer. So, well, there you go. Got it done before the bell rang. Questions or comments here? This really is. These first three chapters really are just... when a TV show has, like, they get a few seasons in and then they do, like, flashbacks that, like, fill in some of the story? I feel like this would be that. This would be those little flashbacks that just tell you a little more. Because are we going to see a lot more out of Joab? Yes. What's going to happen to Joab? David's going to order. He's going to order. Joab's going to order Uriah's death. But Solomon, he's going to tell Solomon specifically, you need to kill this guy. He's trouble. He is going to cause problems for you. You should kill him. And Solomon's like, got it. He kills him. So yeah, I think that's important to remember, that Joab's going to be a thing.